And now, I'd like to introduce our main speaker for tonight, Rick W. from Oxnard.
Hi, everybody. My name is Rick Wilson, and I'm an alcoholic. Oxnard in the house. What a great meeting, and I appreciate our first speaker tonight. First of all, I'll be known as the tall speaker, and at least in my mind. And the best alcohol did for me was make me feel 5'7" tall. So I want to know what he was drinking. Do you ever go to a meeting and a guy said, "Hey, I haven't found it necessary"? Actually, I did went to a meeting, an English major here. I have gone to a meeting recently where the speaker or the leader stood up and said, "I haven't found it necessary to drink in over 6 years." And at the break, I cornered him and I said, "Hey, what are you talking about? You were drunk last Saturday night." And he said, "Oh, yeah, but that wasn't necessary." And sorry about that. I don't think that's what I said, is it? Okay. I got my eye on you. This really is a wonderful addition to Alcoholics Anonymous. And to me, it just proves that Alcoholics Anonymous is really a varied and vast group of people, you know? And I would ask you to look around the room and really, just by looking at somebody and tell them whether they're an alcoholic or not, you know, really. It's a good-looking group of people, and with very few exceptions. You really can't tell the alcoholic in the room, right? Alcoholic behavior is a misnomer unless you're drinking, I think, and alcoholic thinking. I like to say, don't confuse an alcoholic who is thinking with alcoholic thinking. Is this being transcribed? No. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, I really do. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous who has recovered from the disease of alcoholism as a result of working these steps. And with your permission, I'd like to take the last 10 or 15 minutes of my talk and go through the steps. Is that okay with you guys? And show you how I do it. So we can do it in 8 minutes, but I like to stretch it out to 10. But the other thing I don't want you to do is to take my brevity as an insult to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I am an AA cheerleader. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know you guys do too, because this is a great meeting, and I'd like to thank you for asking me to come here tonight. And my buds who drove down with me tonight too to be here with me. And do you ever get in a meeting and you say, "Hey, you know, there was like 50 years of sobriety there"? We figured it out on the way down that there was over 100 years of sobriety with 4 people in my car. And I got to tell you, that doesn't impress me at all, you know? I've never thought, you know, so what? You know, really? Hey, that's really good stuff. No, that means you got 4 old guys, you know, is what you got. Going back to drinking, whether it's necessary or not, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous sometime in July. I wasn't planning on I didn't come for the right reasons, but I came here sometime in July back in 1977. And I'd like to tell you that it hasn't been necessary for me to drink since that time, but it's been necessary for me to drink at least 100 times. You know, it was a while back in 1977. I was 26 years old, and my brother died as a result of the Vietnam War. It was necessary for me to drink, because that could have been me, you know. His number, he was born the day after, it was back, the day before me, 2 years apart, and the draft, it was just his, anyways, you know, it was my brother. When my mom passed away, you know, a little French-Canadian lady married to an animal, my dad, you know, and when she passed away, it was necessary for me to drink. Hell, when my girlfriend left me, it was necessary for me to drink. When she came back, it was necessary for me to drink. But I got to tell you, because of the power that's in this room and these rooms and rooms like this, And the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, I stand here before you, and I have not had a drink, even though it was absolutely necessary for me to drink. I have not had a drink since sometime in July back in 1977. So that means I got 33 years of sobriety. And, yeah, right on. Dude, yeah, it doesn't impress these guys either, you know? And I don't know if it impresses me, but you know who it impresses? The guy with 32 years of sobriety. You know? Can you stay sober? Because I know it doesn't impress the newcomers. The newcomers are thinking, oh my God, how old is he? It's got to be... it's got to be like 40 or something, you know what I mean? Not quite that old, but... So I don't know, you know, I'm a member of, you know, like I say, I'm a cheerleader of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA. I go to a meeting. I've been sober almost 33, or a little over 33 years, and I go to a meeting every day. And when I came in here, nobody said to me, go to 90 meetings in 90 days, you know? You know what that's like? I got sober in July, and that's like saying, hey, come over here, you can't have a beer all summer long. Isn't that what that's like? 90 meetings. What they told me was go to another meeting. Go to a meeting today. Go to a meeting today. And if you can go to one today, you can go to one tonight. And that's what I did. I went to meetings. Oh, by the way, I came here for all the wrong reasons. Anybody here for the right reasons? No? Yeah? Couple of us? Yeah, that's good. I came here for all the wrong reasons. So if you're here tonight, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you, I was in the bathroom washing my hands and... You know, I always wash my hands before I go to the bathroom. And there's a guy in there, and he said, hey, are you the speaker? And I guess he didn't recognize me, and I had a tie on. So, by the way, I wear a tie tonight because I believe when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I don't normally wear a tie, you know. I really don't. I think that people can wear a tie and disrespect Alcoholics Anonymous as much as a guy wearing, you know, flip-flops coming in. You know what I mean? So I don't put much credence in that. But... if you ask me to wear a tie, I'll wear one, you know? Because when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So if you're an addict here tonight and you want to fight, just tell us, hey. But if you want to get along with the group, lie to us and tell us that you're an alcoholic too. And then you can have coffee and cake and nobody will... Boy, that didn't go over. But that's what I did. I came here for all the wrong reasons. And okay, so I guess I'll get to the end of my story. I was 26 years old. I was trying to commit suicide. I wanted it to be painless and temporary. And while I was figuring out the temporary part, I figured that I would check into Camarillo State Hospital. Okay. Liars. Camarillo State Hospital. And back then, you know, so because I was, if you get certified crazy, they'll pay you, right? To go to they'll just pay you to not do nothing. So I was trying to get certified crazy, and if you're trying to do that, I want to warn you a little bit. They don't have the checks waiting there for you. You have to apply for them, which I thought was inconvenient. And so they gave us Bugler, you know, till our checks came in. You know, Bugler, tobacco, I guess they still do that. Oh, they don't even let you smoke in there anymore. But and then they don't give crazy people caffeinated coffee. So they gave me decaf Folgers crystals and warm water and Bugler. And I couldn't roll a joint, and I couldn't roll this Bugler very well, so I'd be smoking it and spitting it out. Somebody told me they had an AA meeting on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday down the hall. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night, and they had cookies in there, and the guys and gals that would come in from H&I, thank you very much for H&I, you saved my life, you brought in filter-tip cigarettes, Marlboro 100s, and you put them in a jar, and you left them over on the coffee table, wherever the coffee table was, and you left them alone and turned you back, and so I would steal them. And you brought them in for me, but I stole them. And, so I would get filter-tip cigarettes, caffeinated coffee, oh, hallelujah, hot caffeinated coffee, cookies, and what I thought then was the smell of non-crazy perfume, and I learned differently. But so that's why I came to AA. Back then, you could smoke in the meetings. You know, as a matter of fact, I think it was mandatory. Because if you went chain-smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee incessantly, we'd say to you, hey, maybe you're not an alcoholic, you know? Maybe just try Al-Anon or something. But do we have any members of Al-Anon in the house? Welcome, welcome. How'd you get out? I'm just kidding. I'm a smart guy. Some people are gonna thank me on the way out, and other people are gonna kick me in the butt. So that's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I got there, let me tell you a couple of stories to let you know that I'm a drunk. I went to high school for 4 years, quit my sophomore year. Doesn't make me stupid, it makes me uneducated. And one time I was driving down the street and I realized that I had to throw up. And I'll tell you a little bit of background about that is that the reason why I had to throw up is because I had a glass of whiskey between my legs and I was pulling down whiskey. And everybody knows that whiskey's poison, right? And I must have got paid because I would rather drink whiskey than beer or wine because I urinate a lot. And the less intake, the less outgo, you know? I always thought that going to the bathroom was a waste of time, so I would like to streamline my drinking. So I would drink straight whiskey if I could. Hell, I used to take needles and stick them in my arms and put things where I like that one. I just like to do that, you know? I'm just a weird guy. And I'm thinking about that now. I can't think of anything else. What was I doing? Oh, I'm driving down the street. I'm driving down the street and I'm drinking whiskey and I'm going to have to throw up. But I got to tell you this, that there isn't a part of my life that I haven't not always drank, you know. And prior to this, I guess I had been drinking Boone's Farm apple wine, the sweet wine, you know. It's not really apple wine, they just make it near an apple orchard so they can call it apple wine. And I don't know about you, but wine has especially that sweet, expensive stuff, you know, that was like $2 a bottle, wasn't it? It was expensive, and it would have a loosening effect on my bowels. And whiskey always wanted to make me throw up till I get some in me, right? So I was headed out. I think it was a Wednesday night. And I don't know why I remember that. But I'm driving down the street, and I'm trying to drink whiskey, and I'm going to have to throw up, and I pull off to the side of the road. And I did get off to the side of the road, but I didn't get the door open, and I threw up. And I didn't want to get it on the inside of my car, so I which seemed like a good idea at the time, but it came out of every hole in my head, you know what I mean? Through my fingers, up on the windshield, all over the front of me, out of my ears, I really believe. I think there is a tube that goes there, but it was just a horrible mess. And at the same time, I filled my pants with Boone Farm apple wine. And I'd like to be able to sit here tonight or stand here tonight and tell you that I was mortified, that was a humiliating point of my life. And I got to tell you that I was inconvenienced is what I was, you know, because this meant I had to go home and I wasn't going to stop doing what I was doing. I was going to go home, clean this up and continue on with my life the way that it was because I needed to get what I got from alcohol. You know, you know what I'm talking about. If you're an alcoholic, I needed to get that. And so I threw up a little bit, you know, on the inside of the car. But I'm sitting there and there's, you know, there's all over the inside of the car. And so I didn't know what to do. You know, I couldn't see out the windshield. So I turned the windshield wipers on and had no effect because it's all on the inside, you know. They'll thank Brad, by the way, is the one who got me to speak here tonight, so if you have any problems with that, you can see him. But that's the story of my life. You know, I went home and I cleaned up the car, you know, hosed it out, changed my clothes. Hopefully I took a shower and I continued to go home. But where it all started was in Byfield, Massachusetts. Are you a maniac?
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
Bath.
Bath, Maine? Oh, okay. Well, yeah, me and you got to talk. I come from a small town in New England, small town in Massachusetts called Byfield, And I was standing out in the ballpark one day, about 10 or 11 years old. I forget really how old I was, but I was trying to muscle down. We stole some whiskey, and I was trying to get it down so I could see what was going on and with this whiskey stuff. And And before that, I got to tell you that I grew up in the town that I grew up in was really small. My dad was a town drunk, and you were instructed by your folks not to hang around with guys like me. Then they'd say, "I told you not to hang around with those Wilson boys," you know. And I'd be right there, and I thank God, you know, these guys are, you know, I'm sensitive. You know, I'm standing right there for crying out loud. And the stuff, if you grew up in an alcoholic family, you know what I'm talking about. And if you didn't, I don't know if I can really explain it to you. But there was a lot of ugliness that happened in my house at night when my dad came home, you know. And so when I went to school, I couldn't look at anybody in the eye because I felt ashamed of who I was and where I lived. I mean, when you drove by my house, it was obvious, you know, oh, there's the Wilsons, you know. It's painted three different colors, you know, and the lawnmower halfway through the lawn and, you know, a couple of junk cars. And, you know, it just wasn't a pretty sight, you know. And I went to school, and I couldn't look at anybody in the eye, and I'd walk around like this, you know. And I started recently in church. That's a lie, because I haven't been in church other than tonight for a while. But I heard a song, you know, over the past few years that talked about God being the glory and the lifter of my head. And I got to tell you, that day in Byfield, Massachusetts, in that ballpark, alcohol was the glory and the lifter of my head. Because what happened was I walked into the ballpark looking like this, and I took a drink of alcohol, and boy, it just rocked me back on my heels, relaxed my shoulders, made me feel 5'7" tall, you know, and it changed my gaze from here to here, and not a lot of people noticed. It didn't look like a big deal, but it made all the difference in the world to me. I could start, for the first time ever that I can remember, I could look at people in the eye, and I felt okay. And that's why I've never, this day, actually, I have never tried to quit drinking. I've never wanted to quit drinking. I got tricked into it, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But I never try to quit drinking because alcohol did wondrous things for me. It made me feel okay. And then I took a couple more drinks, and then I thought, what the hell are you looking at, pal? You know, it really did change who I thought I was, you know. And my first drunk driving, I was about 15, you know, before a driver's license. I had a bunch of drunk drivings, you know. The last one was really expensive. I think it was $175. Yeah, I know. It was horrible. It was a horror. Or 10 days in L.A. County Jail. So I took the L.A. County Jail. You ever been to L.A. County Jail? For $175, boy, I wished I could have paid it. Anyways, wasn't a smart move, but that's okay, because I've made a lot of stupid moves in my life. One time I'm driving down the street, and I wake up, which is exciting. Like I say, I went to high school for 4 years. Doesn't make me stupid. Makes me uneducated. I had this sense that I was going to be in an accident, and I was, just like that. But I got to get away, because I don't have a driver's license. So I'm driving away from this accident. And I realized within a very short period of time my chest hurts because I broke it on the steering wheel on my chest, that my head was bleeding because I put it halfway through the windshield, and that I've knocked out my front teeth. And the car wasn't in much better shape. And I realized that I wasn't going to be able to get away, that it wasn't going to make it, you know. So I drove, I don't know, maybe a half a block, and I got out of the car, and I threw the keys down, and I started to run. And the reason why this was because it wasn't my car. So I could have got away, right? If I got away, it wasn't my car, so, hey, it's not my car. And the other thing is that I don't have a driver's license. And the reason why I don't have a driver's license is because I lost it for drunk driving. And I don't know how old I was, maybe 17 or 18 years old, maybe 19. So I'm hoofing it, you know, that's what we call it back then, hoofing it, and I'm running. Threw the keys down and started to run. And I didn't realize this, but there was a cop behind me, watched the whole thing. And as I'm running, he says those words that I've always hated to hear from cops. He said, "Hey, Rick." And uneducated, not stupid, I realized that even if I did get away, that it would just be in the morning before he got there. So I just threw up my hands and I thought, you know, what could I have done differently, you know? And my front teeth are knocked out, so I'm talking funny and I'm whistling funny, foo-foo-foo, and that kind of tickles me. But I look around and I realize that this is a situation. This is a serious situation. And what could I have done differently? Because I'm a getter awayer with. What can I do differently to get it? You know, what could I have done? You know, maybe if I took that last turn. The first thought that came to my mind was, Rick, if you weren't drinking, this would never would have happened. If you weren't drinking, this never would have happened, you know? And the second thought that came to my mind almost as quickly was that if this is the price that I've got to pay to get what alcohol gives me. Amen. I mean, I just smashed up somebody else's car, knocked out my teeth, broke the steering wheel on my chest. Once again, I'm being arrested for whatever it is they're going to arrest me for. And if this is the price that I've got to pay to get what alcohol gives me, because you understand what alcohol gives me. Alcohol makes me feel okay. What do you want? What do you want? My family? You want my, you can't have my mom. You want my wife? You want, what do you want? I'll give it to you. And you know what? The truth of the matter is this didn't happen every time I drank. You know? It only happened 2, 3, maybe 4 times a year. And if that's the price, I'm in, because I got to have what alcohol gives me. So with that kind of attitude, by the time I'm 26, I'm ready to die. There's no fanfare. There's nobody around to write a note to. I mean, 6 of us were living in a one-bedroom apartment in Burbank. It was, I mean, they didn't, you know, if you weren't there, it was just a little bit more breathing room, you know. And so I checked into Camarillo State Hospital, like I said, for all the wrong reasons. And I walked up. There was a nice young lady there. And I said, hi, my name is Rick, and I'm not an alcoholic. And she said, well, what are you doing here then? And I thought, God, I'm being rejected in a mental institution. This isn't going very well. But it was good while I was there because the checks were going to come in. You know what? Having the checks going to come in, it's almost like drinking, right? Do you ever get a bottle where you need to drink really bad, and you take the bottle and you open it and those little things click off, click, click, and your whole body relaxes. I'll speak for me. My whole body relaxes. And I almost don't even need to take this drink anymore because I know the comfort that's going to come when I do. And that is enough to almost make me not have to drink. Oh, I'm going to drink it. But the feeling that I have is so powerful. And I drank. So I come to alcohol. That's like having the checks come in. So I'm there, you know. Hell, I became, what did they call it? I was president of the Patients Council. We lobbied to get the swimming pool opened or closed. I don't know what we did. But one of the things that I did was I went to AA meetings, you know, and I didn't know anything about alcohol. I knew this, that I wasn't an alcoholic. Went to therapy. You ever been to therapy? Wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. My therapist told me, hey, you know what you guys got to do? You guys got to go to home, not home. Oh, you were there too, huh? You got to go back to your dorm, and you got to write a letter, and you got to put the blame of your alcoholism where it belongs, on your parents. So I said, okay, I'm a quick learner. I don't listen to all of it, you know. So I go back to my room, and I'm writing this thing, and it says, hi, Mom, it's me, Rick. I'm in California now, and I know I haven't talked to you in a couple of years, but I'm in California, and I'm in Camarillo State Hospital. I'm an alcoholic. It's your fault. Can you send me $25? And I put a stamp on it, and I mail it. Monday, I go to therapy, and the therapist says, okay, bring out your letters, and I said, I've already mailed mine, and he said, you did what? I guess it was an exercise that we were supposed to bring in. And details. You know, that was back in 1977, and it took, I think they were still using Pony Express to get these letters across and back, you know. But I don't think it was a week later that I got a letter from my mom. And they talk about this being a family disease, and that doesn't mean my brother's an alcoholic, too. It means that I am such a shit... I am so incontrollable, incorrigible, that I just ruin the life for all of my whole family. You know, it's a family disease. My disease is going to cause havoc in everybody's life. And that's what they're talking about, family disease. So anyways, I get this letter back, and it seems like less than a week later. And if you talk about, do you ever hear somebody say this? Or have you ever said this? I know I did. Why don't you leave me alone? I'm just hurting myself. My drinking's just hurting me. Just leave me alone, man. Just leave me alone. And I got this letter back from my mom. And I got to tell you, my mom's a 4'11" French-Canadian lady married to an animal for years, for many, many years. And she's just an angel. I never heard her swear. And I got this letter back from her, and it says, Rick, if there's anything that I did to cause this, you know, and I could see the tears, I could feel the tears through this letter, and I tore this woman up, you know, just as you're tearing up your mom or your brothers or your, your sisters or your kids or whatever, you know. That's what happens with alcoholism. It's an ugly, ugly disease. She said, if there's anything that I did, please forgive me. And I cried when I read the letter. And there was a check in there for $50. But I'm not a nice guy. I thought, geez, she could have sent 100. She could have sent 100, man. You know, but that's the kind of guy I am. You know, it's just I've never had enough of anything. You know, and that's not because I'm an alcoholic. It's because I'm a greedy little son of a. I'm not a nice guy. So, anyways, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for all the wrong reasons, and I wasn't an alcoholic. And I sat out there, and people had charts and graphs and livers and stuff like that. And you know, guys used to. I had a couple of problems with coming to AA. One of them is that people were very old, you know. Some of these guys were 45 and 50 years old, and it was pretty horrible. And, you know, they had livers and stuff that would come out. And say, Jesus, you ought to stop drinking, man, you know. And I was 26 years old. I was, you know, looking good like tonight, man. I was looking good, you know. And I just couldn't understand. And every time I thought of alcoholism or an alcoholic, I thought of my dad, and therefore non-alcoholic. I'm never going to be like him. But they incessantly, for some reason, right out of this book, did they do that here? Every night, chapter 5, chapter 3. God, can't you remember that stuff, you know? It's in the book. Read it when you go home or whatever. But they read it at every meeting, you know? And one of the things that they said in there is that an alcoholic is somebody who has the inability to control and enjoy his drinking. And I thought, well, geez, that's, you know, that's pretty much me. I can control my drinking if situations warranted it, you know? Like if you said, hey, do you want a beer? And you meant a beer. Because I would not drink anything rather than have one beer. Would you? I mean, it just gave me a headache, you know? Or I could enjoy my drinking. And if I was enjoying my drinking, there was absolutely no control. So that was me. And I realized that because I got to the point. See, I wanted to be paranoid schizophrenic with suicidal tendencies. You know, that's what I aspired to because... Well, to me, it sounded more romantic than alcoholic, you know. And I was having trouble when you're a bedwetter and, you know, a thumbsucker. It's, you know, at 26, it's really hard to pick up women. And second dates were, you know, kind of neither there. And although I did have one gal almost convinced it was her wetting the bed. But she said, well, I never did it before. And yeah, that's what I thought, too. God, I could have. Anyways, so I wanted to be, and to me it sounded more romantic than alcoholic, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic, but something happened. I realized that AA worked, and because I think the reason why AA worked was because nobody stood up here and said, hey, you know what your problem, you know what you need to do? This is, hey, you know what, hey, you know, hey, but you to me. What they did was they stood up here and they said, hey, this is what happened to me. This is what I did, this is what happened. As a result of that, I did this, and as a result of that, here I am tonight. And I may not be everything that you think that I should be, but I'm a lot better than what I was. And I got to tell you, I am a lot better than what I was 33 years ago. I am not the man that walked in through the Alcoholics Anonymous doors for all the wrong reasons. By doing these steps, my life has completely changed. And I realized that I was an alcoholic. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting every day. And I have done that ever since I've been here. I go to a meeting every day. And that doesn't mean that I go to a meeting every day. That means if I can get to a meeting, I will go to a meeting. And the reason why I like to go to AA meetings is because we set the bar very low. I mean, hell, they let me in. You know, that's how low we set the bar in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I've come here. I got sober. We're kind of far from Oxnard, so I don't know if you know this, but I was the best chair putter away that Alcoholics Anonymous, in Oxnard anyways, has ever seen. Rick Wilson, anybody? No? Well, what happened was I went to the Saturday night meeting, which was the biggest meeting in town, and they asked me to put the chairs away. Now, I'm not a sports guy, and I don't have, unless I'm doing methadrine, I have got nothing to say, you know. And they asked me to put the chairs away, and I said, okay, you know, that will give me. But the other thing is what if somebody walked in and said, hey, what are you doing here, man? Did anybody ever do that to you? Hey, what are you doing here, man? Don't you know what you did last night? And the answer to that is typically yes, because I've never had a blackout, well, at least any that I can remember. And I've always remembered every rotten thing I've ever done. But when I came into alcohol, when they said put the chairs away, I said, I'll put your chairs away. And if somebody walked up and said, hey, how about those Padres? I could say, hey, let me put the chairs away and I'll be right back, you know. And it kept me busy. And if somebody said, what are you doing here, man? I say, hey, I'm just putting the chairs away. Just leave me alone. And so I did that for about 20 days, so 30 days. And then another newcomer came in. And he started to put my chairs away. And I said, what's up with that? But I watched him, you know. I'm a noticer. And I noticed this, that he did put chairs away, in fact, but he didn't do it very well. And so I got some. So what I would do is I'd put my chairs away, and then I'd go fix his, you know. And I had a sense of accomplishment, you know. It really worked. But something happened. See, when I first started doing it and I was putting your chairs away, now I'm putting away my chairs. One day I started putting away our chairs, and I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. And I've worked the steps as bad as anybody can work the steps, but I worked the steps to the best of my ability. And I'm here to tell you, if you do it to the best of your ability, by the way, it ain't going to be very good. But if you do it to the best of your ability, you can get to stay sober too. And so let's take a few minutes and we can walk through the steps, okay? 15 minutes. I come from a town called Lynn, Massachusetts. We're in La Jolla, is that where we are? Where are we? Where?
La Jolla.
La Jolla. What did I say? Whatever. Do you have a motto here? Like, I don't know.
Surf's up.
Surf's up. There you go. I live in Oxnard now. And our motto is Bakersfield by the Sea. That doesn't get the same ring in Oxnard. You know, they don't say that. But I was born in Lynn, and in Lynn, Massachusetts, their motto was, Lynn, the city of sin, you never come out the way you went in, which is pretty cool. We're in San Diego tonight, right? It's Sunday night, arguably, or maybe not, one of the most beautiful places on the face of the earth. Would you agree? And you're in an AA meeting. Admit it. Done. I believe all the work for step one is done before you get here. What you have to do, just admit it. You know, my life is so bad that I'm in San Diego a Sunday night and I'm at an AA meeting. What's the rest of the step? My life has become unmanageable. Look at the first part. You're in an AA meeting. You want to write about that? Please, go ahead. Is it necessary? It wasn't for me. I was in Bakersfield by the sea, so I had the same kind of feeling. Step two, there's nothing to do with step two. That's a good thing, right? I think. This is my humble opinion, by the way. By the way, I'm right. But is this a, you know. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I came to believe, you've heard it said that way, that a power greater than myself, and I couldn't use God. I had a God-fearing atheist when I came into AA, an atheist, God-fearing. I was afraid that something I didn't believe in was going to get me when I died. But regardless of that, I came to believe that a power greater than myself, Alcoholics Anonymous, was going to restore me to sanity. Not the crazy things that I did when I was drinking, but the fact that I thought that I could drink with immunity, knowing what I had done in the past. That will go away. And the only thing that I know how to do that is to go to another meeting. Step three, made a decision. How many of you decided you weren't going to like me when I got up here? Security? Just the jealous ones, I understand. Good looking and all that, but we make decisions all the time, you know? You should have seen how many decisions we made when we were trying to figure out where to eat, you know? I make decisions all the time. I'm going to lose weight. I know how to lose weight. You eat less and do more, right? I go to the gym on a regular basis. You don't get a body like this without it. You know what I mean? I make a decision to do these things. But I haven't done anything. It's like making a decision to go to the bathroom. You don't get the relief till you go to the bathroom. You know what I mean? So you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. What's God's will? Do you know what God's will is? If I did, I'd be selling it. Because that'd be a valuable thing to have, right? I pretty much know when I'm not doing God's will more than I do when I'm doing God's will. Some people will say, hey, if it feels good, it must be God. There's a lot of stuff that feels good that God doesn't want anything to do with. You guys are from down here, so you've heard this before. I'm not good enough to recite it, so I got to read it. It talks about which path, the right path. It says, dear God, I have no idea where I'm going. As I do not see the road ahead of me, I do not know where it will end, nor do I really know myself that I'm following your will. And the fact that I think that I'm following your will doesn't mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe this. I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope that I have that desire in everything that I do. I hope I never persist in anything apart from that desire. And I also believe that if I do this, that you will lead me down the right road, though I may know nothing about it at the time. Therefore, I will trust you always. And though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death, I will not be afraid because I know that you will not leave me to face my troubles alone. And I have these if you want some of these. I have plenty, so you can pass them around. And I'll come up and get them after the meeting. But that's a real powerful thing for me because I don't know what God's will. God has never, ever, I've been sober 33 years, God has never, ever, not once come down and, one time. I was in the recovery house in Oxnard, and I just wasn't having a good day. Things just weren't going right. Did that ever happen to you? And I went down to the beach in Oxnard, and I'm out there, and I'm slamming, and I said, God, what? Why does this crap always happen to me? And the skies opened up, and a light came down, and a voice came out just as clear as a bell. And he said, because there's something about you that just pisses me off. Other than that, he has never come down to talk to me, never burnt a bush. What he's done is he sent you to me, and that's how God talks through me. And another way that he talks to me is through that still, small voice in the back of my head. And I try my best to ignore it. But, you know, those are the things that happen to me. So we make a decision, and the decision is really the fruit of that decision is the fourth step. Now, the fourth step, have you ever heard somebody say, hey, wait, you know, watch out, you know, let's hold off on the fourth step? That's like somebody saying, you know, you have a headache and somebody says, I've got aspirin here, but why don't we wait a little while before you take them? Because the fourth step is the medicine that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the thing that will change your life. And so I would tell you, for the people who tell you to watch out for the fourth step, I would tell you to watch out for the people who tell you to watch out for the fourth step. And get into the fourth step. It's Sunday night. It's a little bit late into the weekend, but you could do your fourth step tonight. There's nothing in there that you don't know. When I first got sober in the 70s, there was a big, and I don't know, I haven't seen it for a while, but people were going into past life. They were getting hypnotized so they can go into their past life regressions. And, you know, they wanted to know if they were Pocahontas or Chief Sitting Bull or whatever it was, you know. Because they wanted to remember the stuff they had forgotten that they couldn't remember. And so when they asked me, they would say, well, Rick, what about the stuff I can't remember? I would say, don't write that stuff down. It seemed to work for me, you know. And to go through the four step would really take more time than to do it justice. But I can tell you that in the beginning, it's really very simple. It talks about who you're mad at. It talks about a grudge list, you know. And who you're mad at. If you can figure out who you're mad at, you could probably figure out what they did. And then there's starting some other things in there where it talks about what it affects in you. And you may need some help with that. And please, by this point, have a sponsor so they can walk you through that. One of the things that I would ask you to look at is the fear inventory. And the fear inventory, for me anyways, there was a point where I redid the four-step. And by the way, I've done more than one four-step. You ever hear people say, you only do one four-step? You never, you know, the rest of it's done in a 10-step, you know? Not once have I been here and I've heard somebody come back and say, hey, why'd you get drunk? And they say, oh, I did one too many four-steps. So I think that if you just do it, you know, by the way, the 10 steps says continue to take personal inventory, which is a four step. Okay, enough of that crap. But if you do that, then you can set yourself free. And the fifth step is just sharing that stuff, you know. And people say, well, why can't I just do it with God? And we say from practical experience, we don't get that connection well enough. Again, God has never come down and talked to me. But when I'm doing it in front of somebody else, and when I was doing that, I'll tell you this, that I didn't write down the one thing that I wasn't going to tell anybody about, you know, and I didn't even write it down. And when I sat down to do my fifth step with this guy, he started to share with me to make me feel a little comfortable. And he shared an experience which was the exact experience that I didn't put down. And as a result of that, he saved my life. And God is into saving lives, but he does it through us, right? And so the fourth and the fifth step are very, very important. Step six, good news, nothing to do. It is a statement. In the present tense singular, it says, I am ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That's exactly what it says. There's no work to do there. There's this much in the big book about it. It says, I am ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And if you've done the first five steps, you will be ready. But let's say you're not. What do? Then you have to go back. How far? I don't know. How far? To four? To three? Maybe to one. I don't know. But when you get back to six, it says, I am ready. Step seven says, ask him. Right? And you know why there's 12 steps now? Back in the beginning, you know that there was only six, right? And I've got this on good authority. Bill, on the way home to write the book, stopped at Starbucks and got a triple venti, a couple of ad shots in there. And he started to write the book, and bingo, there was 12 steps. If you did it the day before, you only had to do six. Now you got to do 12. I would ask you to do it real quickly because you know there's a group someplace, probably in South San Diego, that's trying to make this a 24-step program. So if you do it now, you can get away with only doing 12. So step six, I am ready. Step seven, please take this stuff. Step eight, even in the book it says eight. We've already got the list. It says make a list. By the way, you already have the list. You made it when you did the fourth step. Rarely are they complete, so you complete the list, right? And then you make amends in step nine. Amends, not amend, two different words. You make amends, which means if I broke a window, I replace the window. If I stole $100, I replace the $100. If I broke your heart, that's a little tougher. But I do the things that I need to do, and that's where we work on this. But I make amends to the people that I've harmed, not the people that I don't like. I've always thought you were a pompous ass. I'm going to AA, and I'm beginning to believe in God, and I'm sorry that you're a pompous ass. We make amends, which means reparations. We make reparations for the harm we've done other people. We don't change our lifestyle, although that's probably going to happen, but we make amends to the people, direct amends, eye to eye, face to face, or even over the phone, if necessary, to the people that we can. And that's a tough thing. But the book says, if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we're going to be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And we're not saying that you've never been free or happy before, because I know a lot of you have done drugs and drank alcohol, right? You know freedom, you know happiness, but we're going to show you stuff you ain't never seen before. But you can't just get there. You got to go through the process. If you take a caterpillar out of the cocoon before he becomes a butterfly, he dies, or she dies. I guess a caterpillar would be a butterfly, or a butterfly would be... My time is almost coming up, actually. Okay, just another hour, is that good? I think I hear bells in my future. So step 9, step 10, continue to take personal inventory. Step 4, all over again, just continue to do the stuff that you've done up to this point. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve the conscious contact with God. Prayer and meditation, prayer talking to God, meditation listening to God, right? And again, he doesn't come down and say, Rick, you know, he brings you to me. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of doing all this other stuff. By the way, other things will happen to you too. So it's not the only thing that's going to happen, or it's not the only thing that happened to me. But having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I tried to carry this message. And the message that I hope that I've conveyed tonight is that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And that's the message. Yeah, I'm a nice guy, wonderful guy, you know, all of that stuff. But, nice guy, I understand. But Alcoholics Anonymous works through a set of spiritual principles. And if you do what we did, you can get what we got. I'm going to finish with this. A little boy wanted to go to the circus. His mom told him he could go if he worked really hard. And this is about sponsorship, because some of you people haven't sponsored anybody yet. And I'm here to tell you, if you get 3 months sober, how long was Bob sober before he started sponsoring people? Look it up. And so he's got this stuff going on. If you haven't sponsored some, you're missing the boat. This boy wanted to go to the circus. He got a ticket. He worked all summer. He got some coin, and he went to the circus. And as he was coming into town, luck would have it, the parade, the circus parade was coming into town. And there in this parade was a wondrous sight. There were jugglers and you know, giraffes and all this stuff. You know, it was like an hour long. Just, you know, elephants roaring stuff, you know. It was just a wonderful thing. And then at the end of the parade, they were cleaning up, and they had a little collection thing, and he threw his money in. And he went home, and his mom said, how was the circus? And he went on to explain how beautiful this is, how wonderful, he'd never seen anything like it in the world. And the point is that he never got to see the circus. He got to see the parade. I'm here to tell you that this is a great parade. We got a lot of good stuff going on right here. You know, we're involved and we do stuff, right? There's good-looking people and we just do all this stuff, and it's a wondrous thing. But if you aren't sponsoring people, you aren't getting into the big talk, because that's what the book talks about, working with an alcoholic one-on-one. If you got 2 weeks of sobriety and somebody's new walking in the door, you can help him. He's not even going to want to talk to me. 33 years. Oh, my God. Who would want to stay sober 33 years? Not me. Not me. 2 weeks of sobriety. You can help him. You can show him where the bathroom is. You can get him a cup of coffee. And I can't. And I'm done. And I want to thank you all for listening to me tonight. Thank you for having me.